What's up, everybody? As you know, I am Jason Timbuktu Diakite, and I am only one half of this moment, with the other being my dear brother, Chef Marcus Samuelson. And together, we have created the transatlantic bridge between Stockholm and Sweden and Harlem, USA, that is this moment. And this week, our bridge crosses over Minneapolis, Minnesota, where we're going to highlight another dynamic duo. The legendary hip-hop group Atmosphere, led by Sean Slug Daily. So let me tell you about Slug, folks. This guy has been around the rap scene for a really long time. And while Minnesota was more known for Prince and Bob Dylan, Slug and his crew, they created a strong hip-hop scene and built it from the ground up, DIY style. I can relate to it. He's a co-founder also of Rhymesayers Entertainment, and has helped connect Minneapolis to the rest of the world. And I was definitely bumping Atmosphere tracks back in the days when I hosted a nationally syndicated hip-hop radio show called P3 Hip Hop out here in Sweden. We're going to talk about those early days of Slug becoming an MC in Minneapolis in the 80s and 90s, life in Minneapolis, Prince, family, and so much more. So let's just jump in, folks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The guest that we have for y'all today is nothing short of a legend, international, or I should say the global hip hop scene. Everybody worldwide knows who this fellow is. Established, founded one of the most legendary indie hip hop labels in the past 20 years in global hip hop culture. We have none other than Slug from Atmosphere on the podcast. Welcome,
hey,
Slug.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that introduction.
Great to have you.
Yo, like I might sample that. That was beautiful. I appreciate that. It's kind words.
So Minneapolis, you know, in Minnesota, when you were American and Swedish and Swedish American, Minneapolis is almost like the capital. That's like where so much of our Swedish heritage culture is.
It's the little Swedish foothold in the United States.
And I've cooked there a ton of times, and I've been there many, many times. And as we had restaurant Aquavit, I was always looking for sort of the culture, the music scene, because it's a really, really vibrant music scene. So, Slug, tell us about Minneapolis music and how you came up in the city.
For me, I'm very fast to say coming up in Minneapolis was a blessing in many ways. You know, when you're younger and you're an artist and you feel like the world is against you and trying to hold you back and keep you down, you know, you have all these things that you will prop up to prove how much of a struggle it is to get heard by somebody. Coming from Minneapolis, it's actually true. It's not a place that people go checking for, or at least specifically when I was younger, you know, but within itself, it had a flourishing scene and people checked for each other. It's like, it was almost as if like we all knew, I'm not driving to Chicago to go see a show. That's a little too far. So we have what we have. And then it's a flyover city. It was when I was younger for a lot of the national acts and the international acts, they would go to Chicago. And so we really had to learn how to depend on each other to get what we needed, especially through those winter months we had to go out and see shows. We had to go to people's basements. We had to go to wherever we could go to connect with other advocates as well as connect with artists. You learned how to kind of depend on yourself and your surroundings for that. And so it oddly nourished us and it nurtured what we were doing. But in the same time, in the same breath, we had no idea if what we were doing was right. There was no way for us to, we had no mentorship. There was nobody coming through that we could look at and see, you know what I'm saying? You just had what you had in the magazines, on the television, and then with your friends, you know? And so specifically when we're making hip hop, you know?
I'm from a small town in the south of Sweden called Lund. And what you're saying rings so true to me because we basically had to invent our own scene. Because there was nothing there, and you know, bands would come there because there's a university in the town. But I can see what you're saying. It's like a plant school, like where you can come up and prepare yourself before you kind of go out into the world and kind of have your skills or your little sword a little sharpened at home in your own world before you kind of swim out into the big sea.
But fully, Sean, there was talk. One of the things that always amazed me with Minneapolis, right? If you go through the whole Prince route, right? That, you know, even before they're super famous, you think about the Times and you think about Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and all of that. The talent pool, the amount of bands that there were in Minneapolis, right? And that's obviously not necessarily directly in the hip-hop scene, but out of that, there must have been a lot of talent that you were surrounded with that coming up in that sort of way must have been interesting, right? So a lot of your friends must have been in that surrounding. Tell us a little bit about that, because you know there is talent in Minneapolis, tons of it.
Oh, yes. You know, growing up for me, I never picked up an instrument. I immediately went to the turntable. I wanted to be a DJ. And so I had my eye on other DJs. And that's specifically who I was trying to study. And some of them were hometown heroes. You know, some of them were hometown celebrities. You know, you get 50 miles outside of the city, nobody knows who they are. But in the city, the whole neighborhood, that whole part of this town. But of course, we were all aware of Prince. We were all aware of the Time. We were all aware of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. You know, I heard rumblings of things like Husker Du and the Replacements, and there were scenes here that even as a teenager or a young adult, I hadn't quite discovered. I'd never heard the Replacements until I became a grown up. You know what I mean? But then I was like, wow, that was going on at the same time as this. And the 80s were cracking. You know what I mean? Like, but as a kid, I wasn't fully aware because I was looking at the DJ. Prince was the one thing I was really aware of. And I love my aunt specifically for introducing me to Prince. She was a teenager when Prince started popping with like Dirty Mind. Yeah. I was even, you know, I was like a 9-year-old, you know, but my aunt was cool to me, you know, as a teenager. She's a grown up, but she's a kid. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so anything she thought was fresh, I thought was fresh, you know? And so I fell in love with Prince early on because of my aunt. Mm-hmm. So I'm buying Prince records. By the time I'm 11, 12, I'm buying Run DMC records. That's what I had. If you were Prince or anything that he touched, you know, the family, the Time, all that stuff, you know, I hadn't even really fully gotten to understand Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis yet at that point. Yeah. You know, it wasn't until I tried to learn how to mix that I was like, oh, this SOS band thing works. You know what I mean? Like, so with that, I knew that, you know, greatness was achievable because Prince wasn't just from the neighborhood and wasn't just who my aunt thought was cool, but he was on the TV. Mm-hmm. He was greatness. And so as a kid, I understood greatness was achievable because this guy who went to the same like high school my dad went to is great. You know what I'm saying? And so I do think that played a role on me specifically, but also a lot of us, you know what I'm saying? Because even though by the time we were moving around the city, even in our teenage years, Prince was no longer accessible to any of us. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like he was huge. But the fact that the ghosts were around us, you know what I'm saying? Mm. And specifically because it was just him. I would think that in a city like New York or, you know, even to go globally, London, Berlin, Paris, in them cities, there are so many greats that have come out of there that you don't even notice the ghosts. They're just everywhere. You know what I'm saying? Whereas with Prince, it was just Prince. And so there was just the Prince ghost. There was the rumor of this greatness, you know? And so I wanted that. And I didn't know how I was going to get it. Like I said, I wanted to be a DJ. You know what I mean? Like, and that's what I was going for. So that's what I was really trying to like get in on. It wasn't just, I grew up fully in love with this culture. I wanted to rep it all. I wrote graffiti out, breakdance out. I wanted to be a DJ. I even rhymed. I didn't take rhyming very serious. It was like my least serious of it all. Cause that was more like, oh, that's just, I'm clowning in the hallway at school. Yeah. But I loved this culture, but I also loved the idea of attention. I wanted people to look at me. I wanted people to like hear me. You know what I'm saying? I did not want to be anonymous. And so, you know, as much as I'd love to be like, hey man, I really chased after this because I love this culture and I was such an advocate. I know that there's a part of me that also just was like an attention whore. I just wanted people to see me, you know what I mean? Look at me. You know what I mean? Like I wanted to tell jokes. I wanted to be the class clown. I wanted to make people laugh. I wanted all that. And so I feel like when Purple Rain happened, I saw that in Prince. I was like, this dude is an attention whore. He wants people to laugh at his jokes, all that. And I totally related to that as well. You know what I'm saying? When I seen that movie the first time, I had to see it in the Dollar Theater because I was a kid. Nobody was letting me in to see Purple Rain in the main theater. But at the Dollar Theater, they'll let anybody in. You know what I'm saying? And so we waited until Purple Rain hit the Dollar Theater. And yeah, I was mesmerized. Like I already knew I liked them, but I have not. Was this even answer the question? What was the original question?
We're just vibing and riffing off. You know, being a musician or an artist or rapper or an aspiring young DJ in Minneapolis was like. And now our two paths diverged. The similarities I could see between Minneapolis and Lund, Sweden, because we never had a Prince. So I guess what I'm hearing you saying is that there must have been some kind of pride in that legacy that, oh, yeah, we have this hometown hero. His name is Prince. And global pop music god as he was or became in the first part of the 80s, that really must have lifted the entire city. So that's one thought that I have. But also if, would you guys see him around town? Like, I guess he was out on a perpetual tours, but he never really left Minneapolis at the same time. He had his, you know, Paisley Park was there and stuff.
I never went to any of the parties at Paisley Park. I had friends that would go and I almost didn't want to because I didn't want to like see behind the curtain of what I had built in my own head. You know what I mean? So people would often be like, do you want to go? And also I knew, what are you going to do, man? You're going to go out there and stand against a wall. I'm not going to go. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm going to do what I do here at these spots. And I can't just go there and do that because there's, you know, it just wasn't right. So I saw Prince one time outside of the times that I've paid to see Prince. Like I've been to a handful of shows, but one time he showed up at a spot that, in the 90s that we used to freestyle at, you know, they used to do this thing on Wednesdays where they would let people from different
rolled into a local, like open mic night.
Night. He rolled up. Yeah. He was friends with a woman. Robin Robinson was her name. She was on the local news here, but she was like a celebrity because she kicked it. Robin. You'd see her. Okay. Yeah. So they were friends. She brought him to this spot one night. We all really like it felt like she did that as a favor to us. You feel me? It was one of these things where I was like, did she really just bring Prince up in here? This is tight. You know what I mean? And that's the... That's the one time I ever was like actually in a room with dude.
And did you get on the mic that night?
I was already on the mic when they walked in.
Wow.
We were on stage. There was a handful of us. I've told this story before, but not to too many people. We were on the stage like we do, and there's a fella named John on the piano, and you know, I can't remember who was on drums, but it was
It was with a live band.
The live band on Wednesdays. Yeah. It was called Freeloaded Wednesdays. Yep. Mm-hmm. And here he comes. And one of the other MCs standing next to me is like, hey, is that little dude over there? And I'm already knowing. I'm like, I'm like, that is, you know? And this is the mid 90s, right? So I hadn't really gotten too far outside of my city, but in my city, I was bubbling. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so I do, you know, I just go in and I'll rhyme for 20 minutes. You don't cut me off. You know what I'm saying? So I just go in and I start rapping. My eyes are closed. Wow. I'm just vibing. And it was like when we freestyle with the band, it wasn't just like, you know, I'm over your head like a rafter. It was like, you know, start trying to describe a tree and all kinds of crazy. Yeah, you know what I mean? It was like, it was just stream of consciousness, you know? And all of a sudden John starts beating on the piano and I'm like, oh man, he's showing off. You know what I'm saying? Like he's going in. And usually, you know, they'll give you some breathing room to let you do your thing. But right now it's like I'm battling with the piano today, and I turn and look and it's him.
Oh,
nice.
Seriously.
So I was like, let me fall back. You know, so I'm going to shut up.
So you were actually jamming with Prince.
I got to rhyme for, I'm going to say somewhere between 60 seconds and 3 minutes crazy. On top of. We had an overlap, a transition. Once I realized he was there, I fell back because I was like, hey, I can't rap to what he's doing. It's just, it would be wrong.
It's also,
you know what I mean?
Crazy. Like, it's also crazy. It's like a pro, it's like, you know, from the part of Sweden where I'm from, we have a pro football, soccer player named Zlatan Ibrahimovic. It's like he's hopping in and seeing some kids play soccer and like, all right. I mean, it's like a true
No, it's not.
I'll tell you what. As a young kid playing soccer that night, yes, it was. Hopping in that game with me made me go, oh, okay. Because for the rest of the night, I had to step it up. Even after he left, he hit the piano for like a handful of minutes and then hopped off the stage and beelined out the door. Dude was in the building for under 10
to check anywhere else.
He was like, okay, I did it, you know? And it was enough to make me step it up that night and maybe for the rest of my life. Who knows? You know what I'm saying? It's like,
I also think with Prince, it's also interesting because his relationship with hip hop has always been interesting, right? Like there's only a couple of times where he really, really, really goes in lyrically on it. Obviously it infuses his music a lot. And inspired him, but like Sign of the Time, that's obviously like that's a time when he does it. Get Off a little bit later, he has a couple of rhymes in there.
Alphabet Street.
Alphabet Street, you know, he works with it there. It's not a lot throughout the whole
I will say that maybe rapping was the one thing he couldn't do within music. I mean, he could dance, he could play every instrument, he could sing, you know. But
no, he really couldn't. You're right.
He wasn't a great MC. Or a great rapper, I'll say.
You know, it was like when he rhymed, it reminded me of like when greats are like going, oh, that's what's happening now. Let me touch that too.
Even though
you shouldn't be touching that. You know, you saw greats doing it. Quincy did a few things here and there where you'd be like, I don't know if Quincy Jones needed to go there. You know what I mean? Like they're just when I really step back and look at it, they're just touching it. When Prince was rapping, I took it personal. Almost every time I heard him rhyme, I was like, oh, stop. You know, like,
yeah.
But now in hindsight, I'm like, you know what? He just was touching him. Man. Yeah. He just had to show, oh, I can write a concerto. I can do this. I can do, oh, I can bust a couple of rhymes. He had to touch it. He had to see. What if
just like he had to touch that piano at the, you know, at the improv night, you know, like he couldn't just let it be for one. It's like, no, I'm going to get up there. But it's also kind of a true musicianship to be like, wherever there's music being played, I'll join if I can. And of course, being Prince, who's going to tell him no at any point, right?
And it felt like a favor to us when he did that, things were like, oh, a little bit more lively. You know what I mean?
That
like,
is dope, man.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the city Minneapolis? Because I spent a lot of time there, and it's kind of like some hidden gems. It's a twin city, right? So very different energy between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then it took me a long time to kind of figure out where's the black culture, where's the culture. And then you have places like Uptown and places like Loring Cafe and places like that arts, you know, the arts and culture can really breathe. People know about First Avenue because not just Prince, but there's been a lot of shows and stuff like that there. What was some other spot? And culturally in Minneapolis, St. Paul, how did you guys get around and where was the best sort of clubs for you guys to perform and come up in these twin cities?
For us specifically, I grew up on the South Side. And as a younger kid, I didn't have the opportunities to travel to St. Paul or the North Side to go to parties. I had to take buses. I had to be back home by a certain time. I was trying to live by the rules, but I still had to go party. So we would go to the park jams. There was a couple of DJs and DJ crews who would basically do the same thing I read about in the history books, only they did a Minneapolis version of it. They would go into the park and they'd be like, yo, we'd like to, you know, put together a party, you know, in the gymnasium of the park. And then on a Friday night at like 6 p.m., there'd be a party from like 6 to 10 or 11. You know what I'm saying? And it would be geared towards people who can't go to the clubs.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And people would be breakdancing. The DJ would be scratching and mixing. People would be hanging out, wearing whatever their nicest thing was that week. You know what I'm saying? It was the full experience for somebody like me who didn't know any better, you know? And so going into these things and meeting other people who like to go out and write on shit or seeing people, you know, rhyme battles, things of this nature at this young age, I was really kind of fortunate that we had this kind of a scene going on that allowed kids to take part in. I was a kid, man. I was like 13, 14 years old, you know?
So we're talking late 80s, like 80,
87, 86, like 86, 87, yep, 87, yeah. Yep. And, you know, that turned into, at least for me, I started really collecting 12 inches after seeing parties like that. And I started really growing my record collection. I'm doing odd jobs, shovel sidewalks, just so I could be part of a record pool and get records. Like I was a DJ. Like I told them, I'm a DJ. I really am. Yeah. And so I got into the record pools and started getting records, you know, and building my library and making little tapes, you know, and I never really quite got it as a DJ in town. I never got it. It didn't happen. My path didn't lay that out for me. What ended up happening instead is I got into music. I got into going to see bands play, going to see rappers play, all these things. And I was just like, man, like I'm not progressing, really trying to, you know, am I even really trying anymore? I'm writing rhymes now. What's happening? You know, and by the time I really got it, I'd already transitioned to rapping. Mm-hmm. Now, during that era though, there was so much because now I had a car, or at least homies who had a car. So I was able to go to St. Paul. I was able to go to the North Side. I was able to do these things. And that's when I really got to start to see how many dope DJs there were in the city. And I think that helped kind of reinforce that I am not going to be that dope. I don't have, I don't have the drive.
You could see that already then.
I could see that. I didn't have the drive.
Because it's interesting what you're saying. I think anyone, like I think about Marcus, for example, as a chef and myself as an MC, it's as a kid, you imagine yourself there way before you're there. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't realize, or I didn't really ponder the fact that for the first 5 years as an MC, that my songs were not that good. Not until, you know, later could I look back and say, oof, that was really awful stuff. But luckily somehow I kept going, right? And didn't let go of it. I love stories like that. Like you saw yourself in a place way before you were there. And I don't know if we lose that ability a little bit when we become adults, or if we lose that ability a lot when we become adults. I'm sure that's different, but I just think it's beautiful. You were dreaming about being on a level that you weren't at yet.
Oh man. I was dreaming about being one part Jam Master Jay. And then I wanted to be on the radio. I felt like the DJs that were on the radio were the greatest. So if you could be Jam Master Jay on the radio, if you could mix and scratch live on air, you know, that was the epitome. And as I transitioned out of it, I had a friend who was like, I need a DJ for my group. I just need somebody to cut and scratch behind and play my beats. And I was like, I can do that all day. Like, I got this. Cause then I can hang out with you. We can practice, put together our little sets and our little sequences. You know what I'm saying? And that transitioned into him going, you know, I used to see you rapping. You still rap, right? And I'm like, yeah, I rap. And then I just became the other rapper in the group. So I fully transitioned out of DJing, aside from later in life where I'm like, man, I want to DJ a party now, especially now that I can. Now that I can be like, hey, I want to come DJ your party.
Beat and then be like, oh, is one thing, but you don't have to hit the like Transformer scratch. Anymore,
oh man,
right? I guess.
I could honestly, I'll get up there now and just make a mess. And if people, you know, it's one of those things now where it's like, I'm going to do it just to do it. Like it doesn't, you know, I don't expect greatness. But it's more like, I want to just have fun.
On one level, let's face it. I mean, I imagine like if you go down to the you know, the local improv night now where MCs, if there is one where MCs are freestyling, it's going to have a similar effect to when Prince came to the one, I imagine it, back in the days when you were a kid.
You know, that's, I have never actually put that together, but you saying that right now kind of freaks me out because, yeah. Cause I do show up at the things.
Yeah.
You know, this is actually touching
on. That's touching kids, you know, the people that, you know, 13, 17, whatever, who want to come up, because there are the two major themes are not only are you, you know, founder and 50% and half of legendary hip hop group that is known around the world, Atmosphere, but also equally known and legendary Rhymesayers Entertainment. You know, those are two huge achievements that not everybody does. So I would imagine if I was a kid and I was from the same town as you and you step in, I'd be like, whoa, okay, I want him to hear me rhyme because maybe I'll get, you know, signed to Rhymesayers or whatever.
See, this is something that I was oblivious to until recently. I had a conversation with a friend of mine and he said a few things that really resonated. And what you're talking about right now is bringing me to that. And here, and I'm just going to talk about it real quick. I had, I wouldn't say a difficult time. It was impossible for me to see myself how other people see me. I don't know why. I just didn't consider it. And so in doing that, I maybe intentionally I stayed oblivious to who I was to other people and just stayed in touch with who I was to myself and to my people who are close to me. Yeah. So when I walk into a room, I forget that maybe these young MCs see me as such and I just see who I am. And I feel like I've done a disservice to myself as well as to others in doing that. And that's something that I've actually been trying to work on and look at is like, you know, you got to meet people halfway because you also should be according and you should present somebody that is in line with how they're seeing you, but you should present your best version of that. You know what I'm saying? Because it's it's important to model that, but it's important to be aware of just not self-awareness of who you are, but who other people see you as. And I thought I was doing the right thing.
But that's a fine line, I think, with fame in general is that I think it's like, for your mental health, I think it's important to keep what you're saying that, you know, see you as who you see yourself as and want to be
fully.
Rather than try to think, oh, what are other people thinking about me? Of course. But at the same time, as you're saying, being able to just embrace the kind of voluntary and involuntary mentorship that being somebody famous from a place means that people are going to learn just by seeing what you do. And some may learn from hearing what you were actually telling them. It's a fine line, but it's very interesting.
It's real. And I feel I love it. And now I'm waiting for this plague to get over so I can go out and exercise that and deal with that, because I feel like it's important for me to figure out how to deal with that. I feel like, you know, and as you said, you know, the mental health side of it is a part of why I was always like, just keep it real, be true, be what you, you know, how do you feel? But it's like, the truth is there's so much room for misinterpretation. And so if I'm not having the best day, like anybody doesn't have the best day. And if my energy gives that off in a particular environment, that can actually become detrimental to somebody who may, you know, it's that don't meet your, that don't meet your heroes kind of thing. And that's not me saying I'm anybody's hero, but more so saying, hey, you know, there's a reason why we say don't meet your heroes. And that's because you find out they're regular ass people with regular ass problems, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to hide the fact that I'm regular people with regular problems, but I just want to make sure that I nurture this relationship that was created before I even met this person who's standing in front of me right now. You know what I'm saying? It's like that person may have an idea of who I am and I've never seen this person before. And so I've got to make sure I'm nurturing whatever this relationship is between us. It's how I talk to everybody now. It's like even talking to you guys in this podcast, it's like, I want to make sure that it's like, hey, you know, you say these nice things about me, Rhymesayers and this and that, but I'm this dude. So how do I find a way to meet in the middle and make sure that I say, hey, thanks for saying these nice things about me, but still also show you I'm just a fucking dipshit like everybody else.
Sean, tell us a little bit. How did you like, I'm going to start an indie rap label. That's a exactly. big idea. That's a big idea, by the way.
You started that even before the group.
Yes.
So, yeah.
It wasn't so much that we, interestingly, when we talked about my grand visions as a kid of what I wanted to be on that stage, by the time I got into my 20s, those grand visions went away. Mm. I rapped in a local rap group for fun. There was no future in it. I knew that. I had a child already. I was working full-time, total work ethic guy, getting up at 5:30 in the morning to go to work. And I rapped on the side because it was a way to have fun and still connect with my friends. It was an excuse to smoke weed too, which was kind of had become a thing in my life in this time. You know what I'm saying? In this time, I was like hippie. This was hippie Sean. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that's what we used to say back in the day with people whose potheads were hippies. You know, like it was a different Sean. I was peace and love and trying to figure out how to adjust to the universe as a dad and as a person who wanted to love my job because it provided health insurance for my kid type of a human. And then people started going, man, I like your raps. And that was, we did not foresee this. You know what I'm saying? And I reconnected with somebody I'd went to high school. His name is Sadiq. He, for all, just to keep it, you know, super obvious and Sadiq is really the brains and even the drive behind Rhyme Sayers. You know, his last name is Sayers, Rhyme Sayers. It's named after him. You know what I'm saying? And so
nice.
And so the contribution that we made, the thing that makes us partners, is we went out and did the rapping. We went out and made the music. And then we contributed resources to our belief in his idea. You know what I mean? But Rhyme Sayers is him, you know? And I love when people they give me all this credit. And I'm like, man, could you imagine me having to make decisions for a record label or any kind of business? Like, that's just not in my wheelhouse. You know, it never has been. I am a work ethic person. I'll go do the work. You tell me what you want. You want stickers up on that mirror? I'll go put stickers on that mirror. You want me to hang posters? You want me? That was me all day. So that was my contribution to it.
But I see a similarity, Marcus, with how being a chef on the level that you are and also running a record label or being a co-owner of a founder and co-owner of a record label that is also very kind of has this magnetic effect on artists, you know, all over the world, is that you both have a responsibility for these like up and coming stars or people that are already stars. And it's dealing with a lot of people's expectations, maybe disappointments, but just like, it's a lot. Myself, I ran a little indie hip hop label in Sweden for 10 years. And it was really, I found it really difficult to kind of be responsible for other people's dreams in a sense. Mm-hmm. And especially when things didn't go the way that they wanted. Now, for all our listeners out there and for those of our listeners who may not know, like Rhyme Sayers on their roster through the past two decades have been people like Brother Ali, Dilated Peoples, you know, Atmosphere, of course, Aesop Rock, Jake One. Hasn't MF Doom even released stuff with Rhyme Sayers and Budo from Seattle, Blueprint. Yeah, just like incredible.
Jean Grey has done stuff, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow, we haven't been fortunate enough to have any Jean Grey records yet, but I'm going to hold my breath for that. I want that one.
Yeah.
Touching on that, it's like I, as an artist, tend to kind of be like almost like I'm the artist friendly person. Other artists talk to me. I'm not a suit, I guess would be one way to put it. Not so much that I'm the artist ambassador, but more so like I'm an actual artist and I have issues with the label. You know what I'm saying? We
go with your own label.
That's interesting.
We go through things, you know what I'm saying? It's like, and so with that, I do feel like it allows artists to talk to me, or at least when I'm giving them information, they can take it and see what kind of value is on that because of my position, you know? And that is, you know, that's the other important thing that I note about the label is that I don't make any decisions there intentionally, not because it's not chess. I'm not playing chess with it. It's that I don't trust my decision-making in that yeah. world. You know what I'm saying? I could never be like, oh, here, make decisions on what another artist is going to get from like marketing budget. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much room in there for, you know, conflicts of interest too, yeah. that it's just like, I'd rather stay clean of all of it, you know? But I do know when we started, we had no idea that we would work with all these artists that you just named and more. And we literally did it out of necessity. There was no next step up on the industry, you know. Mm-hmm. When I said I had moved to rapping, I started rapping with this friend, an old friend, Sadiq Sayers, had reconnected with us. He was rounding up a bunch of dope MCs from Minneapolis and St. Paul because he wanted to start a label. So he was basically like farming the talent. Like he would have people hang out with each other and he would have people over to his basement and everybody would be sitting around rapping, talking, dreaming. And there I was, his age, going, yeah, I don't know about all this dream, but I like hanging out with you guys rapping. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I did not foresee a career in this. I thought I was doing this and I was just killing time. And it was just a great place to put my energy and work. You know, it was just another place to keep me from doing anything. Making horrible choices. Yeah. I was making these other choices, you know, and as a new father who was confused and who was trying to organize and do things the right way, it felt like a great use of my energy. And if I only smoked weed there, I was doing great. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not taking it home with me. I'm not, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it became, I wasn't going to bars and stuff. You know, it was like my weekend spot to go make songs. And that's how we met Anthony. He came in and started providing beats for all the different people that Sadiq was working with and whatever. And, you know, the clubs weren't letting us in. We had gone through a few things. There had been a few pretty large fights that occurred. One fight occurred at First Ave at an Ice Cube show. And it was famous in the city for what occurred. You know, it was like a huge ordeal because they like fought the staff. Like they went, it was like, I ain't gonna say no names, but there were actually people on the tour fighting. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it was like famous, you know? And as magnificent as it all sounded, it squished the hip hop scene in the clubs. Because First I was like, you know what? We can't do hip hop anymore because every time we do, there's some kind of fight. And then all the other clubs see that and they go, well,
same story all around the world. Yeah.
So we started throwing our own shows inside of coffee shops. Coffee shops are like, what do you want to do? And we're like, we want to bring in 2 turntables, 20 rappers and do spoken word and freestyle for 4 hours. What do you think? And the coffee shops are like, that sounds great. You know, so they let us in and it was incredible.
Wow.
The energy. It was like, who needs a bar? Yeah. It's like, there's no alcohol here. People are still just lit having this. The energy was insane and everybody knew it and seen it. And that's when we were like, oh, this is not just us kicking in the basement. You know, we went in there with the whole conglomerate of people that Sadiq had been pulling together and pulled off a show that was freestyle off the cuff, nowhere. And people left feeling like they had gotten something for their $2. Yeah. Right. And we just kept doing it over and over and over. And then we started really like hammering out the promotions of it on just flyer. You know what I'm saying? Flyers, record stores. We were taping up posters backwards, facing inward at the colleges and the high schools, so that when people came to class, if there were any still up, these things were just glued to the windows. Like we were just dumb with it. And it worked, you know, and it just was one baby step after another. And a couple of us started trying to get on the road, we pressing vinyl, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just how the label started, fully because none of us felt either confident, or somebody like me who felt like, well, that's a waste of time to send demos off to some place in New York. You know, who's going to look at, hey, I got this Manila envelope from Minneapolis. Anybody want to hear this? Hell no. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so we just did it to do it, you know? And And again, I don't think anybody at that label, including Sadiq, I can't speak for him, obviously, but I'd be surprised if he could ever be like, yeah, I knew this was going to happen. I knew this was going to pop off, because I don't think any of us did. I think we were just like taking it as it came. What was in front of us? Do it? Should we do this or not? All right, let's go.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know,
but it's a great story, you know.
It's a great incredible story. And you know, you're more than two decades,
both
with
years.
Rhymesayers. Yeah, both with Rhymesayers and Atmosphere. You got your father of three now. So I guess, you know, your oldest must be about as old as you were when you started Rhymesayers.
Oh, he's older. Yeah, he's older.
He's even older. So very few artists, very few hip-hop indie labels have that lifespan to be, you know, current, just to survive that long. How is it now where you are now in life, being a part of Atmosphere? Of course, now you haven't been on tour during the pandemic, but you know, up until then and inshallah afterwards as well, of course. But how does that look like for where you are in life now?
Oh, it's interesting because we have, just like how it started, we still have no idea what we're doing. Like, we've learned a few, we got some muscle memory for when certain things show up, but there's plenty of things that we're just like, well, what do you want to do about that? You know what I mean? It's just like, you're still just kind of taking it as you go. And we're not, if we had some kind of thing, we're like, okay, every December we record every this, but it's like, it's still always just like all over the place. And so I still kind of feel this weird rush of adrenaline every time I have to like stop and figure out what the next 6 months to 12 months are going to look like. You know, we've learned a few tricks, play the old songs live, but still put out new songs on a regular basis. Play the old songs live, put out new songs. And it used to be like, oh, we made a record. We made a record so that we could go on tour. Exactly. And now I realize we don't have to make a record to go on tour, and we don't have to go on tour to make a record. They're two very, very separate things for us now.
That is, yeah, that's a deep insight, though.
It's a good place to be. It's a good place to be, because when I make my music, I don't have to even consider, like it used to be like, I don't care what people think. I'm making what I want to make. Yeah, everybody has that feeling, right? Until people start to like your music, then you're like, oh, I wonder if they're going to like this, you know? And then I'm at this next phase where I'm back to like going, I don't know that it matters if people like this new album or not. Like I'm making this to make Anthony laugh. This song was so that he would be like, oh, I can't believe you said that. This song would be so that he would chuckle. This song, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm back to making music specifically for the immediate reaction of Anthony first and foremost. Then I want to see what my kids think when I play it in the car without even like introing it, just be like, oh, that kid is singing the chorus. Oh, that's tight. Yeah. You know, it's back to me not really having to consider what the audience thinks, just like it was in the beginning, you know. But the difference is, in the beginning, you were like, I almost defiantly, I don't care what the audience thinks. Now it's not even a defiant thing. It's just kind of like, it doesn't matter if they like the new music, if they trust me, if they trust where I'm going to go with this music. They might hear this record and be like, yeah, I'm not feeling it. And then 5 years later, be like, yo, that record actually was good. And I didn't even realize, you know what I mean? It's like, I have this process with it now where it's kind of like, if it grows on you, it grows. If you like it out the gate, I'm cool with that too. I still want to take left turns and not give you what you was expecting. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I don't know what people want. I don't know what people like. I know that they want me to play something from 2007. Every time I get on the stage, I'm fine with that, because I still have a pretty good relationship with a lot of that music. You know what I'm saying? It's like, there's certain songs, just like you might know, there's certain songs of your past that you might, I don't ever need to play that. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to show it. I don't want to be it.
They're often the ones that don't work too well live anyway. It's like the natural kind of musical Darwinism kind of thing.
Yep.
They kind of fall off. But okay. But let me ask you a piece of advice, just from one MC to another, seriously. Because I'm only the father of one, and I became a father late. So I was 43 when I had my daughter. She's now 3.5. Beyond everything else, and Rhyme Sayers, within Atmosphere, you're also, as I know you, is as a dope rapper, you know, who writes and spits really kind of literary lyrics and like stories and like, you know, a real bona fide MC. Like, as a father of three, how do you find time to write that type of, like, to spend those hours in the studio to write those lyrics? I mean, both through the years, but also today.
3.5 year old. I have a kid that just turned 4. That's a great age,
by the way.
Yeah. And I have 4 kids. I got 4 sons, actually. The oldest one's an adult. And then somewhere in my late 30s, started having them again. And yeah. It's very, very different experience between the first kid and then the next batch of kids. But the time that I had to create a work schedule where I would wake up, do what I had to do as a father, get kids out the door to school, what have you, and then immediately go to the studio. Boom. And I would be there until lunchtime. And then at lunch, I would maybe go and have lunch with whatever family was around. And then, so I kept the studio close, you know what I mean? And so it's like, but I had to treat it like a job. And I feel like if I just would have waited around for, you know, inspiration to strike or something like that, who knows? I wouldn't have been
those 16 hours in the studio, you know, smoking a J and waiting for like, just vibing. You can't do that anymore.
I go and I just start writing and I force it. And then ever since I started forcing it, I love it. It's like it actually gives me, it's like now I feel like there's a purpose that's way more than it's almost as if the destination is no longer as important as the path. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm, it's like there's this purpose that I'm working with that I'm akin to, that if even if this doesn't end up being a song, that part of it didn't matter. What mattered was I'm using the muscles, I'm working, I'm doing this, and I'm getting it in, you know, I'm compiling material for no reason.
Marcus, you must have the exact same kind of feeling when you had Zion, that like, because I mean, I know you spend hours and hours and hours and hours, like all the waking hours of the day in the kitchen.
Well, first of all, listening to this conversation, I really love it, because your path in many ways are very similar, right? You guys in the mid-90s, 96, I mean, Jason, it's kind of like parallel, almost like your career path, and to listening to this and also coming from, we all come from smaller cities, right? Lund, Gothenburg, Minneapolis. And I think it's also very aspirational to listen to all talent doesn't come from London, New York, or Paris, or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just thinking about your timeline with Juju Record. It's a little bit after, but it's pretty similar. Like, you know, that idea of having, being a chef and owning a restaurant, but mostly being on the cook side, right? I can have I can have issues when I'm on the cook side, but as an owner of the restaurant, I have to think about from the owner's point of view. And I also don't trust my decisions on that, right? So I kind of leave that to a partner, because I know what it is to be a cook and feel, you know, that grind. So I'm very biased, you know what I mean? And most of the time, it's actually not beneficial for the restaurant. I'm mostly just with my crew in the kitchen, right? So there are so many creative similarities. Obviously, your pathwork is more in the same field, but as a creative, you know, you just have to plow forward. And the love for the craft, when I think about all the three of us paths, right, we basically came up around similar time, and it's like the love for the craft, you know. And you talk about, Sean, you talk a lot about work ethic, and you know, for me too, like if I'm working, then I wouldn't go out and do something destructive. So like the restaurant, especially when I was a kid coming up, my parents were so happy I was working in the kitchen, because, you know, as other kids, they stole a car or they did other stupid stuff, right? I didn't have time to do any of that stuff. So I always feel like food always, and kitchens always saved me from a lot of extra time. I didn't have time to mess up. But the one thing that we've had more laid out as a path that maybe the music world doesn't have the same, it's mentorship. You are not considered a chef unless you mentored. Being a chef is not just cooking. You are a mentor. This is like the unwritten rules that part of getting that chef dumb is that you are mentoring at least a bunch of young students that, you know, you're saving from doing something wrong, or you're elevating. So I think that's one thing that was very helpful to me, to have mentors coming up. And I still have mentors. I have young mentors and I have old mentors, you know, and all the mentors for me now. Mm. I have mentors now that are like 26 that teach me about young shit, you know what I mean? But that's like part of being a chef, and where I was like, okay, that's interesting, because you have to mentor it through even when you have bad days, and you have to be transparent about that and share, like, listen, you're catching me on a rough day.
I will say the mentorship the way I experienced it with often older rappers or, you know, musicians, was that they weren't trying to teach me shit. But I could observe what they were doing and learn by kind of imitating almost. You know?
Yeah.
One guy who actually taught me how to, as I would write my rhymes in my notepad, group them into two bar groups and taught me about bars and stuff.
Who was
that?
Give me his name.
Kwaku, also known as Kent.
Yeah.
You know, dope guy.
Yes.
I owe him a lot. That was the only kind of voluntary mentor I had. Sorry, Sean.
Why do you think that that in rap there was less of a mentorship?
When I came up, everybody was like all the other MCs, and especially the ones that were older, were trying to be, you know, stars in their own right. They weren't really trying to look out for, like, I had other friends that were MCs, and we'd all, but I don't think we saw that as mentorship. We would just hang out, just like I picture you guys in Sadiq's basement in Minneapolis. It was just, we were vibing. It was freestyle sessions, but also kind of a friendly type of competition going on? Because you were always trying to outdo each other and, like, you know, drop a cassette tape in with something really new and fresh that would blow your friend's mind.
So do you think with the older heads, they shied away from mentoring the younger heads because of the fact that the younger one was there to replace them, the competition? You know what I'm saying? You don't want to teach the person who's going to end up, like, eating you. I guess
in a sense, maybe, or just that we weren't good enough, you know, when I was really young.
Because hip hop specifically, you hear and you see a lot of the back and forth of the older heads criticizing what the younger ones sound like. And mm-hmm. it's funny because mm-hmm. when I was a kid, my father, who, I mean, technically was probably the first person that ever played Rapper's Delight for me, because it would be on his the radio in his car is where I would hear this music. And at the time, I didn't even know that's hip hop. And that's not, it was just all music in my dad's car, you know, but he would be the one to later in life be like, well, this Run DMC, this is noise. Why are you listening? You know what I'm saying? And then, so now you look at the older heads and the way they criticize, and it's almost like a rite of passage to become old enough to criticize what the younger ones sound like. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And the younger ones nowadays, like, we used to at least have a little bit of reverence for the older heads, but just a little. You know what I'm saying? We had to get older to finally start saying, oh, I really respect the elders of rap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's like, absolutely. But you don't say so, that when you're 19.
No, man. When I was 17, I loved Melly Mel, but I wasn't like, yo, I respect Melly Mel. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, now I am older. Man. I'm like, yeah, Melly Mel. You know, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, there's a, not an ageism, but there's just almost this, like, generational beef that happens here that I think keeps the mentorship from, and I concern for that because I want to be a mentor, but it's a weird space to try to occupy because it's like, for me, that means I'm trying to show you I know what I'm doing. Cause if you look closely, I don't know what I'm doing. You know what I mean?
It's also different. You know what I mean? Like, you, as a kid, as a mentee, you got to be open for it. Like, when I came up in Sweden, I knew that I had to go abroad. And there was an older chef that's just like, I will send you abroad. And I was like, when? Tomorrow. I was like, I'll tell you when. I'll tell your parents when, right? Give you 6 months notice. And he did, to the dot, right? Like, boom, he sent to Switzerland. When I came to the States, this guy that I've admired so much, I had one of his books and I had to save up to get his book. His name is, rest in peace, Charlie Trotter from Chicago. He came to dinner in a restaurant and walked in after dinner into my kitchen and said, you need help.
Wow.
He just walked straight in and said,
see, that could be devastating.
Yeah.
Too,
and I was like, stood there, but he's like, and I'm going
to
help you out. He didn't just say, acknowledge, like, and he's like, you need help, but I'm here to support you. Right. And I was like, I'm going to mentor you. And I was like, okay, should I call you? No, I'll let you know. And like 3 months later, he faxed me something because it was back in the day. Come to Chicago. We have this chef event where you can be a fly on the wall. And it was a chef event with Nobu and Ferran Adria, which was El Bulli, which was the biggest chef in the world at the time, and this guy from Australia. And he said, you're not allowed to touch anything, but be a fly on the wall and watch these guys, and that's it. So every 3 to 6 months, I got sort of a fax or a call from one of his people, and I just made myself available because I knew each time I would learn a lot. And it was that he did that for 10, 15 years for me until I was like, okay, I got it, right? And he just, that was him, just like grabbed it and said, you're talented, but you need to edit your shit and no one is editing your shit. That's what he was telling me. And I'm here for you. And it wasn't just him, it was his whole crew. Now I had access to like 30 young cooks that came from all over the world. And eventually I started sending my cooks up to Chicago. And that's how we got this jump start and became this badass kitchen early, because Charlie Trotter opened the door for me, right? And that transformed my life. So I knew after that, I have to start mentoring. And I focused more on inner city black and brown kids because there was a huge void for that, right? But it was, he just said, you need help and I'm going to be the guy to help you.
That's dope.
Yeah, it is dope. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know if we have the same type of kind of like old masters vibe within you know, I'm guessing that the American hip hop community is the same as the Swedish, even though yours is thousands of times bigger. But where, like, it's like either you can rap, you can write a good song, or you can't. And once you can do that, you're pretty much, you know, okay, an older artist might have a longer track record, but it's still like, you know, sure, you've been a star for a longer time, or you've done more stuff, but check me now. I got fresh stuff that everybody wants to hear. And then there's not really levels in that. You know what I mean?
But you are that person, Jason, in Sweden.
Well, no, I'm just
you
saying,
are that
I'm
person for that, a lot of people.
But with chefs, it seems like there's more like really established like steps. Like this is an old master. Like we revere what he says. Also, probably because teaching somebody to how to kind of act on stage or how to write or how to just carry yourself, or they're all like more like in your character. It's like emotional. It's like hard to teach. Whereas being a chef, there's a lot of like technique and there's a lot of different techniques. Sure. I'm guessing there's like,
I can see how those techniques though, those techniques are the personality. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's like for the chef, that technique, how you choose to do that, how you choose to, like, I don't know how to cook, but you shake the thing or this
shake
the thing.
The thing.
And
shake the thing. That's what we do. I'm
just telling you what I be seeing chefs
like
do. Like
song lyrics. Yeah, yeah.
You know, how to cook. I just feel like, I feel like
more like chefs are more like DJs. That's what I think.
See, I think it's like this. I think it's like this. I think the rappers now go, oh, wait, you still using celery? You can't use celery. It's like that. You know what I'm saying? It's like in hip hop. Everything changed. We stopped cooking with beef, and now we only cook with this. Older head is like, yo, I used to actually cook with drums. What are you doing? You know what I mean? It's like
we don't use drums anymore.
So, but the chefs, you know, when you're doing the thing with the this and the shaking the things, do you have to also watch what the youth are doing and be like, oh, I got to learn how to do that now too?
Listen,
because I remember,
You know, for me, mentorship is more about the mental stage and which doors and which steps are happening. If you're going to go through that, those are different steps. I speak to young chefs every day that calls me, hit me up, text me. And it's so much about the mental health game, right? Because it's a brutal amount of hours you got to work. And then it's like your restaurant through COVID, maybe or maybe not is making it and you're still working as hard, right? So for me, mentoring is a lot about the mental game, actually, what's happening and what's next. What I love, learning-wise, ingredient-wise, I learn more from the younger chef than from my peers because they're definitely technique-wise, ingredient-wise, they want it faster, quicker, more flavor-driven, right? So
they're teaching you about share plates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
so
stuff
it's like
that.
So but I love this. I look at it as going as a, being a boxer, being in the ring. You gotta go with the ones that you come up with, but you got the young ones coming up, and that keeps me fresh. You know, I love having all the young guys go at me and come at me and I learn a lot, you know what I mean? And it's just like without that, you know, level of energy which is needed, it would be boring, you know. So I'm really grateful at this moment and I just love it. I love it.
Guys, before we don't want to keep you all well it's night for me, but all afternoon, Sean. But before we kind of go, there's another kind of perspective on Minneapolis that I would just love to, but that we need to touch on, you know, because other than Prince, Rhymesayers, Atmosphere, and all the fantastic music coming out of Minneapolis, unfortunately, in the past couple of years, you know, since Philando Castile, and then, of course, George Floyd, it has become, you know, known in kind of infamy as far as police violence against Black and brown people. What has the past 2 years, 3 years been like in Minneapolis, and how is it affecting you and your family, your friends, your music?
That's a good question, you know, because it's hard to differentiate how much of the trauma is based in COVID, how much of the trauma is based in these, I guess, how would I describe them? These these actions and decisions that have been captured on film that really are highlighting to us the disparities and the inequities in our community, basically. And how much of it is just from the overall world. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to differentiate the traumas. And I feel like that probably speaks to a lot of people, no matter where you live. Mm-hmm. But here specifically, it's been really interesting. And it's wild to me because I'm also hearing and listening to a lot of people who are becoming a lot more aware of how we react and absorb trauma, mm-hmm. what it does to us. You know, there's just so much more therapy language that a lot of us grasp now, mm-hmm. and are able to articulate, you know. And so even the hyper awareness of the trauma is traumatic. And I can't speak to the rest of the world how the world feels. I can only just assume that everybody feels like we feel. And I don't even want to speak for everybody here, but for me, man, it's like, it's day to day, man. Some days are really good. Some days are not as good. You know what I mean? And it's interesting because sometimes you can't even figure out why today is not that good. It's just not. You don't always know, like, why does today feel like this? And it's just because of the paths you crossed today, the people you spoke with and whatever they're going through. And as we share these energies. And so in this city, as you say, you know, there's been, it's just nonstop, man.
But can I ask you
something? It's nonstop. Yeah.
It's so interesting because it's such a big thing, right? And to live in Minneapolis, you know, to be defined by these big things, but then you're going to live in there. Like, people are living day to day. Like, on one
you gotta
hand,
go shopping.
Yeah.
Or even people, though there's a huge demonstration.
Yeah. Or people there's, talking about this? Are we dealing with it? What's happening on the ground? Kind of like as an M Twin City citizen that dealing within this world, in the culture world, how is people responding or communicating? Or is it something we're not going there? It was so dark, we're not even talking about it.
One of the largest responses, at least that I've been able to see, is what I spoke to in the sense of people are very aware. Mm. People have been learning the language. So when we talk to each other, it does feel productive. It does feel like this is moving somewhere with a positive energy. Mm. But I can't always tell because sometimes even I'll get off the phone, I'll talk to somebody for a half hour and things will feel great, but I'll get off the phone and I'll have this slight depression after the fact because of what was just... it's almost like the energy that was required to really be present for that conversation. I feel a little depleted. I got to go fill that back up. Mm-hmm. I got to fill my cup up again. And you know, I'm not even like, I don't even leave my house. I'm a very I was already antisocial for the most part. I only left the crib to go. And if somebody came to town that I was friends with, I would go and at least say hi to them at the show. I might not even stay for the show. You know what I mean? But I'm a homebody. I'm either working or I'm with the kids. And so this didn't change that. I was like that before COVID. I was like that before the series of events that were captured and broadcasted internationally. You know, I, like anybody, will remind you and remind everybody that's listening, like, these things happen everywhere all the time. Things are, but these ones were big because they were captured on film. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like, again, it goes back to that footage. You know what I'm saying? It's like, but the thing is, it's just been one after another, man. Yeah. It just feels like you don't even get a chance to really finish dealing with all the loose ends of the last one before the police kill somebody else. You know, it's like, thankfully things have been kind of quiet here for a minute, but also, man, there, you know, it's been, as a rap kid, I grew up listening to all the rap I could. I became a conspiracy theorist through that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning how to let go of some of that kind of a.
Yeah. Cause I hear you. Hip hop and conspiracy theories have gone hand in hand for alternative truths. But now the people kind of co-opting the conspiracy theory space are not people we want to kind of associate with at all.
It's so, it's crazy.
Keep some of that though. Otherwise we wouldn't get the greats like the Sun Ross. Please keep some of it.
It can't go nowhere. It's just, I just can't go to the meetings anymore. That's all it is. It's like, I'm still in on it. I just can't kick it with the other people that have suddenly jumped in, you know? But with that said though, it's like, you know, there's a defund the police movement that got big around the U.S. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's like that everywhere. And at times, man, the conspiracy theorist in me is watching the city like, yo, like these cops just quit. They just turned their head. Yep. They're turning their head. They're just quitting. And it's interesting because it's like what it highlights is like, all right, so now I'm on the road and we're just not paying attention to traffic signals no more. Mm-hmm. It starts there. You know what I'm saying? We're just like, it don't matter anymore. You just better make sure, just keep your head on a swivel. And that's just trying to drive your kid to school.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? So above and beyond that, there is this vibe of like, man, like everybody quit. And I don't want to say just the cops, but it's like between all this stuff and COVID and all the pushback and the division between all of us, like, there's just a whole lot of people who are just opting out. And if you're not opting out, then you're opting in and you're having these conversations with people and it's depleting you and you are exhausted. Yeah. You are exhausted. Yeah. I am emotionally exhausted. Yeah. And like, I'm not even boots on the ground. I'm just mm-hmm. voice on the phone and I'm exhausted. Oh. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, and this city, there's one beautiful thing that occurred is we got to really see how many people in this city were with it and ready to not just hit the front lines because it was the thing to do, but to stick with it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of activism here. You know, there always has been, but it was really beautiful to see it like show up and organize and get things done. So
because and it's really unique and great to be able to hear you speak on that from being a Minneapolis a resident of Minneapolis, because a lot of the footage that we were shown and the demonstrations and the uprising that kind of had Minneapolis as an epicenter, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, sent shockwaves. I mean, there were 10,000 people in the city where I live demonstrating because mm-hmm. of it. But a lot of the footage we were seeing from Minneapolis was, as always before, burning supermarkets. It was looting. It was demonstrators. It was a lot of violence. So we didn't see a lot. The news wasn't showing a lot of those beautiful moments. Or
it's crazy because this is again, the disparity and the inequities here are some of the worst in the country. Mm. Now, when you saw how many people that came out for the protests that were white, it scared a lot of people. And there's this conspiracy theorist in me, but people were like, yo, these young white kids are coming out and burning shit down. What are we gonna do? And so I believe that the information that was shared, the pictures that were shown, they downplayed that. They didn't want the world to see that, you know? And you know, I feel like I gotta look over my shoulder when I speak like this publicly. But yeah. I they didn't want to see that from here. Mm. Like if you saw that happen in New York, that's New York City. Mm. But in Minneapolis, to see all of these young white kids come out like, yo, we will fuck shit up. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong to fuck up. No. But the fact that they showed up like, I'll go to jail. What are we doing? I feel like that may have scared some people, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like there's reverberations to that, you know, here, definitely, but also globally, you know what I'm saying?
I think also a lot of it has to do with how that's reported. For me, the core of this for me is that it's actually a twin city. And I come back to that because St. Paul's financial and energy is very different than Minneapolis, right? But when you hear it out, it's always Minneapolis. I would say this is a hard line, right? But like St. Paul is probably majority Republican and Minneapolis is probably majority Democrat. I mean, it's a hard line, right?
You know, here's the thing. As a kid, we were told, you don't go over to St. Paul. That's its own thing. So you felt like, oh, you go over there, a bunch of Minneapolis kids, you might get chased by some St. Paul kids or who knows what. Once we got over there and started interacting, once we were old enough to start partying with those kids, they're just kids.
Kids, yeah.
You get older and that's when you start to see what the real lions are, you know. And I would say right now, I don't know if St. Paul is as we say red blue is as red now as it used to be. It definitely was worse. It was like, you know, it used to almost be like a joke. It was hyperbole of how horrible it was. You know, now what I think has shown is that neither side was right.
Yeah.
Both sides failed us. Mm. Both sides failed Black people specifically. Wow. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And in different ways, but also in the same way, man. All they did is they put makeup on one and they put something else on the other. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and I feel like that truly is what it comes down to. And so when I say how seeing all of these different kids from different spaces come together and voice their anger of what the police did to George Floyd and the way it sparked off everywhere else in the world, I think that is worrisome to them. And if it isn't, it should be. Because I do feel like there aren't too many more times that you're going to be able to like really push on this little skinny little bridge you guys got here, faking like we can cross this bridge. This bridge is going to break. And then, you know, it's like,
it's all broken. Yeah.
It's all broken. Yeah. And I think that it's everywhere, man. I think it's here because I'm biased. I think, you know, I live in America. Therefore I know America's the problem, you know what I mean? But the truth of the matter is,
it's everywhere. It's in Africa. It's everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, we, you know, here's the thing: can we get there? Can we break the bridge in time to save the world? I don't know, man. I hope so. Yeah.
Well, it's got to be a graffiti bridge, right?
Slug, man, I love this conversation. I feel like we could go on for, another 90 minutes. It's been an honor, a pleasure.
Anytime, man.
You know, you've actually hit me with some advice that I'm actually, you know, taking to heart. I don't have to make an album to go on tour. I just because I released an album doesn't mean that I have to play those songs. That's like very concrete advice that I'm taking from yet another involuntary mentor.
Yes.
You know, listen, man, all you got to do to go on tour is have fun and translate that fun to other people, man. People just want to go and have fun, especially now. If you can, you know what I'm saying? Like, I respect what you've done and I fully respect what you guys got up next. And so I love you. Thank you for having me on the show. If anybody ever calls and says, hey, I can't come, I'm sick or whatever,
there you go.
We're gonna hold you to
that. I'll hang out with you guys anytime, man.
Thank you so much. That love is, you know, coming right back at you. And you know, whenever you're back in not even just Sweden but in this Nordic part of Europe, you know, I'd love to come see you. And yeah, man, I hope to make it to Minneapolis one day. I was about to go when the pandemic hit, but it got canceled as so many other things did. So I'm still looking to come to Minneapolis. I'll hit you up, man.
And I will be there in 5 to 6 months or so cooking. So I'll definitely try to get you out of the house and break bread with you.
You guys are the best, man.
It's inspirational, man. Take care.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right, man. Peace. Thanks again, Sean, for joining us. Shout out to all the rhyme sayers worldwide. Also, shout out to Alien Headman for helping us set this up. Now, make sure you go check out that new Atmosphere project. It's called Word. It's available on all major streaming platforms. Also, make sure to drop by Atmosphere's web store. They sell some dope cassettes, CDs, and vinyls. Always go for the physical copy, folks. And to our listeners, tell us what you think about the episode. Who else should we interview? What topics would you like to hear us dive into? We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a message at thismomentpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram @thismomentpodcast. We'll be back next week. Peace.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.